Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. So I'm Josephine Ensign. I'm here on Jack Straw Studios on Wednesday, May 29th, 2024, and I'm here with Sparrow Etter Carlson. So Sparrow, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so
today.
Much for having me.
So I wanted to start off by just asking you what led you to the work that you do and you have done, continue to do.
Yeah, certainly. I find this always to be like a very, like probably one of the more difficult questions that I'm asked. And I think that like all human beings, I have lived my life trying to find my place of belonging and of meaning making. Being a part of something bigger than myself. And I think, you know, I think place is always really informative. So I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, in an area called University City, which is down the street from Wash U, if you're familiar, if others are familiar. My dad was a Vietnam vet. And I, you know, deeply recall his sense of not knowing his place after coming back from the Vietnam War. You know, and I think that a lot of his trying to make sense of who he was and his identity and, again, like where he belonged after that war impacted just the lens of which I view life and the lens of which I view the other. So I recall my dad, you know, sitting out back in our alley talking to folks that were experiencing homelessness that were, you know, much of this is in hindsight, but these are images in my mind, right, as a child, seeing him talking with, you know, men that were experiencing homelessness that were very clearly Vietnam vets. And those images I have of him are images where I see him feeling at home with himself. And I think that that really impacted me. I think, you know, Josephine, after college, so this would have been in 2002, I studied recreational therapy in my undergrad. And after college, which was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, I got my first internship at a women's homeless shelter in Chicago. So I ended up moving to do my internship at this women's shelter. So, of course, this is many years after just moments in my life that really impacted me as a child. I did my internship at this beautiful shelter, but during my experience there, it was a deep learning experience for me. It was also really challenging, you know, as a 21-year-old young right. woman to really, like, forge deep connections with the women that were staying within this shelter. And I'm telling the story because this has had a deep impact on my life. When my internship was up, I really wanted to stay on and continue working at the shelter. But unfortunately, there were really no positions available for me other than the janitor position.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to stay on and become the janitor of this 40-bed women's shelter.
And just women, not children?
Just women. Yeah. So just women in this particular shelter. There were children that would come there after school. But it was, you know, overnight and during the morning, it was only female-identified guests and community members. So there were, you know, roughly 40 women that stayed at the shelter. So I was now in charge of the 9-toilet bathroom. And so snaking became a big part of my day. And what I found happening, Josephine, is you know, all of a sudden I went from being behind a desk in an office to being alongside and cleaning mm-hmm. alongside these women. And I had a moment, and I'm so grateful. These are my, like, original good teachers. I'm grateful for the generosity of their spirit in sharing with me. But I had a particular moment that really did impact and change the trajectory of my life. And that was one moment where I was cleaning alongside the women in the morning. And as we were cleaning, a bus pulled up. And out of that bus came, you know, a whole slew of volunteers that then went behind the kitchen mm-hmm. and started preparing food.
Mm-hmm.
That still gets me every time. And, you know, this was 23 years ago, so I don't remember the exact words, but the essence of what they were kind enough to share with me.
The women
was like, Sparrow, do you have any idea what it feels like every day to have people from outside of your community coming in and serving you?
Mm-hmm.
We've been raised in this community, and we have never once been asked to be a part, like, to volunteer in our own community. We've never once been asked to, like, create the food that we eat. And that changed just, like, you know, some say, like, the scales on my eyes right. or just, like, again, like, their kindness and offering me that sacred insight really has truly changed the trajectory of my life.
And that probably came because you were working beside them mm-hmm. instead of
yeah.
in a
absolutely
kind of power.
Absolutely.
Kind of role.
Yeah, absolutely. So being the janitor, mm-hmm. Going from being, you know, kind of a caseworker to getting out behind the desk and the gift of being alongside was the greatest gift. And like I said, like just the initial, like, teaching
mm-hmm.
of my life. And then, you know, from there, I received a call that my dad had about 6 months left to live his life. And so I had to step down from that position and move back to Michigan. And then I spent the next, you know, 10 months of my life alongside my dad, being in that thin space
mm-hmm.
of saying hello and goodbye. And that, again, enabled me to be, as a younger woman, just very outside of time and very much close to the heart of – just both the beauty and the pain that we have available to us in each moment. And I think, you know, from that, Josephine, of course, like being a young woman who's very ready to be out in the world mm-hmm. and be, you know, using my skills and my the things I've learned, both
your
my
education
and then, of course, my newfound, like, gift that these women from the shelter have blessed me with. What I had was time to reflect and be present mm-hmm. With my dad and with my family, and to be very aware, that this life is so beautiful and fleeting. So while my friends were out, you know, taking over the world, you know, quote unquote, I was really left to wonder and reflect on what it is that I felt like these women really opened my eyes to.
Mm-hmm.
I can say a lot about, you know, how my life has then, you know, been an expression. And
please do.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you wanna talk about that?
Sure, I can. Yeah. So I think you know, during the time that my dad was sick and I was saying the long goodbye,
mm-hmm.
short long goodbye, I worked at a coffee shop, and it was in that space that I saw, you know, mm-hmm. people from all walks of life. Right? Encountering one another, caring for one another, bumping up against one another. Their lives were intersected. And, you know, as a barista, it became very clear that, like, you know, all of this was very much like being worked out within my spirit, my mind, my heart, that, oh my goodness, how rare are these places of
those
like mutual encounter,
third places.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. Third places are in this world, especially for folks that are experiencing homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
Like how I long to see a space that was, you know, welcoming and inclusive of, you know, the women I had grown to love and had been so deeply impacted and experienced love in return. Where do we go, right? To be enriched by one another. To care for one another. So during that time, I just received a vision for if ever I would have the opportunity to create a nonprofit coffee house. And during the last month of my father's life, I ended up meeting someone in Grand Rapids, Michigan, who was moving out to Seattle, Washington.
Oh, there you go.
And was part of a church that wanted to invest in like a social venture.
Mm-hmm.
And so, long story short, I ended up coming out here and was able to birth in community kind of that first expression of care, which was called the Green Bean Coffee Shop.
Yes.
Do you remember it?
I do.
It was so beautiful.
Yes.
So beautiful. And Josephine, like truly, like the essence of that place, the way that space was just created with the intention and the attention to beauty. And even down to, you know, I don't know if you recall, but when you walked into the Green Bean, there was a big advocacy board.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was done with intention, where every month we supported, we shared about a local or global non-for-profit.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the tips supported that non-for-profit. And this was back in 04, 05.
Yes.
It was, you know, people were like, what is this?
Yes.
You know, but that really was a response to the women to say, like, everyone deserves to be in the know about other people across the world that are struggling
mm-hmm.
and that are trying to survive. And then they also, no matter how much they have to give, deserve to be able to offer that gift, right?
The social enterprise.
Yes,
part of it.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And so, and also on top of that, like we were run by volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
So we had many folks that were experiencing homelessness coming in and sweeping in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and washing our dishes and being a part of creating the essence, the heartbeat of the space. And that is absolutely what made it beautiful.
Right. And how long did it go for? It went for a
while. Yeah. So we, let's see. So we like opened officially our doors in 2005. And then
and it was more in the Greenwood.
Yeah, it was right next to Taproot right? Theater, yeah. across from Gordito's, right. if you remember.
Yeah, I do.
And I don't know if you also remember that we had an arsonist.
Yes.
And that is how we lost our space.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a call early one morning. This would have been, I think, 2010.
So during the Great Recession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that the green bean was burning.
Mm-hmm.
So got in my car and watched it burn to a ground, mm-hmm. burn to the ground.
They had a whole series of
we had arson. A whole series. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. We had – so the green bean, the two businesses next to us all burned down to mm-hmm. the ground. And – and that was a holy reckoning for us because, again, we're like, where do we go?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this has been an icon. This has been, like, in essence, like a sense of orientation for me and so many people of, like, what we – A, of all, like, we need it. Like, I needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And we all felt like we needed this space. It was such a gift to us.
And then have it taken
away
overnight.
And then just to have it gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a deep, deep grief. In essence, we had, caught this vision, caught this, like, again, like, it was the place that held our hope for what can be. It mm-hmm. was the place where we went. I mean, our lives were just so enlivened by just the community that was woven there, that was intentionalized there, the grief and the joys that come with living with intention. So that was a hard season. But out of that came a new expression of care,
mm-hmm.
which is the Aurora Commons. So,
So how long between the burning down of the Green Bean Cafe and the opening, your opening of the Aurora Commons?
Mm-hmm.
It was fairly close together, wasn't it?
Yeah, fairly close. So we had already, as a community, been spending time and intention on Aurora Avenue. So for those who listeners that don't know, the Green Bean Coffee House was on in Greenwood, so 85th and Greenwood. And then just over the hill is mm-hmm. Aurora Avenue. And so myself and other people that are in my friendship group, my community, we all lived like off of Aurora Avenue.
You were part of the community.
And we were part of the community, had been for many years, and so much of our community within the Green Bean Coffee Shop was also folks that you know, were trying to survive
mm-hmm.
along Aurora Avenue. And this was a place of hospitality for them to come and rest and be and, again, be a part of community. So
mm-hmm.
so we had a lot of folks that spent their days in the Green Bean that were experiencing homelessness. So prior to the Green Bean burning down, we had already started to spend time with intention along Aurora Avenue. Where it really began was in the motels.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my best friends and co-founders of what later became the Aurora Commons, her name is Karen Sullivan. She we had gotten an AmeriCorps position for her to spend time and just be present on Aurora Avenue. And the first thing she started doing was bringing flowers to the motel managers, who are a lot of times unrecognized social workers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, over the last couple of years, Josephine, as you can, as most people can see when they're driving down Aurora, many motels have been, have, you know, gone out of business, have shut down.
Have been forced to go out of business.
Have been forced to go out of business, et cetera. But, you know, this was back in 2010 when they were, a lot of them were very much still open and very much the only, this was before we had any kind of emergency shelters, no quote unquote services or spaces of hospitality for folks along Aurora Avenue. And that's just true. Mm-hmm. So for better and worse, those motels were those spaces. And so, as I said, my friend Karen started bringing flowers and just talking and being present, getting to know people within the motels. Ben, the other co-founder, doing the same. And again, after the Green Bean burned down, that was kind of just where we found our orientation. That was the place we moved towards to find our neighbors. We didn't have any place to meet up with them anymore. So it was we missed them. We wanted to be with them. And so we started hosting community barbecues in partnership with motel managers or motel owners. Our first one ever was at the Everspring Motel. And then later in the summer, we ended up working with some of the residents within the Everspring Motel because so many of them are artists. And we created with them like a Saturday open market and set out all these tables for folks to bring out their goods and invited people from the neighboring communities to come on over. And we had a band. We had barbecues. So we started to do that about once a month.
So like little pop-up.
Yeah, little pop-ups that were co-created with the residents along Aurora Avenue that were, you know, both, you know, sleeping on shelter, sleeping rough, and also folks that were, you know, hustling up enough money to have a place to stay every so often within within these motels, excuse me. So that was kind of our animation of love and co-creating community along Aurora Avenue was in the motels. But then my husband and I ended up moving right on what's called Nesbitt Avenue. And right next to the Oak Tree Motel, if you're familiar.
Yes, I am.
And what is
now?
This was now the Aurora Commons.
That's right.
It was not then. So,
and maybe say for people that don't know what the Aurora Commons is.
Yeah. So the Aurora Commons, and I'll get to like
how we
founded it. But what does exist now, just for your own sense of locatedness as a listener and a community member, is on 90th and Aurora. What I'm referencing now, the four walls and the building of the Aurora Commons did not exist yet. But to locate you, my husband and I moved directly behind what is now the Aurora Commons to a fourplex. And our fourplex was at the very top in the back. There happened to be a yard, which it's just very hard, as we all know, in Seattle, especially along Aurora Avenue, to find a home with a yard.
And so, did you have kids yet?
I did not. Oh. Yeah. So when we moved in there, we were like, this could be an amazing community garden. So we got permission from our landlord to start a community garden there. And just to give you a little bit more like insight into what that yard felt like, and the sounds you heard and what you saw around our yard. The Oak Tree Motel, which is a place where it's still existing, a lot of our neighbors, our on-house neighbors, again, hustle up enough money to have a night of sleep at the Oak Tree Motel. The windows, a side of the Oak Tree Motel, were overlooking our garden. And so inevitably, like, it was summertime, all the windows would be open, everybody would be leaning out, everybody would be talking to us as we're in the garden, dreaming and scheming about this community garden. And then in front of our house were a number of neighbors that mm-hmm. were living, having to live in their vehicles and also living in tents. There was an abandoned motel across the street. It had just recently shut down about a year prior. And we as a community had helped to bridge a number of those guests that had lived there for a long time to other house to, mm-hmm. To housing, help them move. It was now shut down, continues to be shut down, Josephine. And those were inhabited by a number of,
right. of squatters.
Of squatters, yeah.
Yeah.
So our neighbors, in essence, truly,
were
only folks yeah. experiencing homelessness because right. there were no other homes in that area. It's hard to put into words, like, just the beauty of what was created that summer. Like
the summer of love.
Oh, right. I mean, it was just,
So what yeah. summer was this?
So this year? Would have been, let me see here. Oh, time. I think this would have been the summer of 2010, I believe.
Okay.
We'll have to go back in the archives and
yeah.
double check that. So again, we had been spending time on Aurora, getting to know folks, so we were able to enlist help, right? None of us knew anything about gardening to this mm-hmm. day. I am a horrible gardener. Like, just...
But you see the good
in yes! it. I mean, thankfully, we have a lot of folks in our midst that know what they're doing
yes.
and know how to create, you know, so... That's what we did. We created these boxes together. We built this garden together. And over that summer, it took shape. And then instead of doing the barbecues in the motels, which we did still every once in a while,
mm-hmm.
we started doing weekly barbecues in our backyard in our garden.
Nice. And using some of the produce?
We did, yeah. But it was still, like, very much getting going, so it wasn't
right.
necessarily.
It wasn't a lot of produce.
That would have been a great goal, but we weren't great at gardening, like
yeah,
I said.
Right.
It was more the thought of it.
You could have
gave us some to do together.
Slugs.
Yeah, yeah, totally. We started doing weekly barbecues in our backyard, and we would have 80 to 100
wow.
people in our backyard every week.
So just word of mouth.
Oh, yes.
From the people in the windows.
People in the windows, people outside. I mean, we had so many people helping, so many people bringing food. Our neighbors that were living out in their RVs outside would always contribute every week. They'd contribute. They'd make food in their RVs. They'd come into my house. We'd co-create food together. And it was children, pets, people that were housed, people that were unhoused, everyone coming together and just mm-hmm. sharing in a meal. And it was never boring.
I'm sure.
And it was just so wonderful. Like, just so wonderful. And we ended up doing that until the rain started.
Mm-hmm.
Until the rain started to be a little too heavy to gather. And then Karen and I started a women's breakfast in my home. So every Friday we would have women, our neighbors that mm-hmm. were out and on Nesbitt Avenue and out on Aurora Avenue would come over and we would make breakfast together and we would sit and just be together. And then we did the barbecues one more summer. And then it started to rain again and we said, we really miss being together.
Mm-hmm.
And what is now Aurora Commons came up for lease. We said, what if we take what we've been doing and put four walls around it?
So the rain doesn't matter.
Yeah. And so we did.
And so that would have been like
2011.
11, yeah.
So like halfway through 2011. So it was, I think it was a total of like a year and a half, maybe a little bit longer. Again, sorry. We continued to do the neighborhood barbecues mm-hmm. even when the Commons was open. So time gets a little fuzzy, but it certainly was. I think, you know, again, this was a community that had really found one another and found a home in one another and very much became dependent on one another and felt our lives just enlivened and enriched by being in relationship with one another. lost the space of the Green Bean, found it along Aurora Avenue, created it out of the neighborhood garden, and wanted more mm-hmm. of that. And our neighbors were asking, you know, for more of that. We saw by, again, like their generosity of spirit and letting us be in mutual accompaniment and be in friendship with them. We saw that they were welcome nowhere, you know, that they were living a certain level of social death and very much excluded in society. We wanted to create a beautiful space of hospitality for them, a neighborhood living room.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. And so you did.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure it kind of started small and then built, like, because now you have medical services there too.
Yeah. Yeah. It started very, very small. So again, hearkening back to my original mm-hmm. kind, good teachers and the kitchen. Really, the only thing that we started with at the Commons with intention was we were going to have a communal kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
That was very important to us. So we wanted it to feel like a living room, like a house that's based around a kitchen, so that our friends and neighbors that entered in, they could come in and they could open the fridge and they had a choice of what they wanted to create for themselves and make for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really, truly the only, like, pure ingredient. I say that, but also we were very clear that, like, we wanted it to feel like a neighborhood living room. We wanted it to be an open kitchen. We were absolutely going to focus on beauty. So we were going to create a beautiful space.
Right. Instead of
not one that felt like everyone bring us all your old.
Yes.
Like,
right.
We know that beauty calls to beauty. And we also wanted to be really intentional and do our best to create a space of, like, mutual reciprocity mm-hmm. and co-creation. So we are very committed to having anything that was created out of the commons, meaning, like, anything that was a response programmatically, to be done in community
mm-hmm.
and out of what our unhoused neighbors were asking for and what we were learning from being in relationship with them and sharing life with them. So, and also, I mean, I think we had a deep, deep commitment to the belief that dignity is not offered. It's inherent, and that we need spaces where we can be reminded of our goodness and again, asked to be a part of something bigger than ourselves, larger than ourselves, that everyone has a particular gift that we're needy of
mm-hmm.
and that we want to call out a particular song or particular note in this ballad of community that we want to hear. So we were really intentional and doing our best to deprofessionalize the space, which is a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because our society is based on hierarchy.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. So that, you know, and of course, with me being a nurse, a public health nurse.
Yeah.
Because I had been following Green Bean Cafe. I went there once because we were trying to get something similar started, the doorway.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Cafe that I was in charge of for 2 years.
Oh.
And some, yeah, so we looked at that. And then also working, especially with teens, commercially sexually exploited, and working with OPS, Organization for Prostitution mm-hmm. Survivors.
Yeah.
So, known about it. So, how did you do that with the healthcare? Because that obviously is so hierarchical and professionalized.
Oh, RC Clinic. Yeah. Again, I'm sorry. It just brings me to tears every time I talk about it. Yeah, I mean, that came out of so many years of accompanying my friends and neighbors
mm-hmm.
To their appointments. And as you know, more than anyone, you know, the folks that I love and that, again, that I feel enriched by, they die unnecessary deaths. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, just being someone that for so many years at every point of the continuum of care was accompanying these people that were, that are so dear to my heart, that know my children, that I share life with, that impact me in beautiful ways. Just to bear witness of how other they are. Mm-hmm.
And the social death.
And the social death. Yeah. And also just all the missed opportunities for mm-hmm. connection, I think, especially in healthcare. It was truly just like almost like a begging for us to respond and create something in a space that
from,
they feel.
From the people mm-hmm. that were.
Or yeah. they feel, or they feel seen and valued.
And respected.
And respected. So I think, you know, you alluded to this a little bit in your own work, but just to be very clear, you know, the women, female identifying folks that I've spent 20 years with on Aurora Avenue, they're the women that are engaged in what we call survival street-based mm-hmm. sex work. And so they don't have four walls. This is not a choice.
Right.
This is truly to take a shower, to eat food.
To survive.
To maybe get $5. You know, they've – the vast majority are polysubstance using, you know, mid-40s and up. That is changing, but I think a lot of people don't understand that really, I mean, they are so socially excluded. Mm-hmm. And so when we would actually go to the doctor, excuse me, to the ER,
mm-hmm.
It would be almost like it would almost always be a matter of life or death, right? Because they're not accessing preventative care. They're not accessing primary care.
Dangerous right. work.
Absolutely. So so when we would go and I would accompany them, I think it was a unique position that I was in because I would almost always inevitably be asked, like, who am I?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I was very committed to saying that I am a neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that gave me a particular insight that is very different than if I would have said I was their case manager
mm-hmm.
or
health navigator.
Or their health navigator. Or and so just being with and witnessing the process barriers
mm-hmm.
to start, the ways that they were not believed, that they were stigmatized, that, I mean, the list goes on and on, right? We as a community were, again, like I said before, like tired of them dying unnecessary deaths and also, just, yeah, wanted them to have access to healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we also witnessed, as you already know and many people know, that so much of their dependency on substances is to treat their untreated illnesses.
Right.
And their mental health.
And trauma.
And trauma.
From the past.
And trauma from the past. And so this is just a complete failure, right, of our system
mm-hmm.
and of our ability to care for the precious other. And so I don't recall how, but I ended up meeting Dr. Darren Reddy, mm-hmm. Sharisha, who helps run the Madison Clinic
yes.
and amidst all the other things that this just amazing, beloved human being does. We began dreaming about starting a clinic
mm-hmm.
On site for female-identifying women on Aurora Avenue. And the first thing we did was partner with UW and a student in the NPH program. Mm-hmm. And she did a needs assessment of our women. So came in and did just an extensive study and questionnaire about how they define health, you know, what their health needs are. And we had already, you know, gleaned wisdom from that just from years of accompaniment. But we wanted to have, you know, again, give them the space to tell their own story and express their own definition of health. And so we did that first. And then, of course, you know, Sharisha and I met for, oh, gosh, I think it was a year and brought along other people in the community and began to dream about what this would look like. And it was from there that we received funding, made a formal partnership with UW.
And that was about what year, would you say?
I want to say this was about 2015.
Yeah.
I want to say it was about 2015. So originally started one day a week.
Mm-hmm.
We called it the She Clinic, the Safe, Healthy, Empowered Clinic.
I remember that,
Which I just love. I still just, every time I say it, I get tickled. I'm like, oh, what a gift of a name.
And did the women help?
The women helped, yeah. And then actually the student from UW.
The public health student.
The public health student helped with that as well. I feel very grateful to her for listening so well. And offering us that gift of a name, the gift of a name. You know, and so even in starting that, Josephine, like, it's such a gift to risk on behalf of these people, right? Of these precious people. Like, you don't know. You do not know if they will come.
Right.
Like, you do your best. You do your best. And the data is clear. They do not access care.
Mm-hmm.
They do not. Like,
for a lot of really good
for
reasons.
For a lot of really good reasons. And even though we've done our best to cultivate this safe space, we've done our best to co-create this particular model of care that we're about to launch, which is the She Clinic, you just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my God. They could barely look up long enough to even do anything other than just survive. Like, but they came. It was instantly, quote unquote, successful. Successful because they felt safe enough and heard enough.
And they'd already
and
been
valued enough to take a moment to care for themselves, which is the hardest thing, right? When you're experiencing unsheltered homelessness, you're having to engage in survival street-based sex work.
And you're a woman or woman
you're
identified.
You're a female-identifying human. You are – a lot of these women live in the deep shame of and desire to be close to their children that they're no longer close with. Like, to move towards kindness towards yourself and your body, they're extraordinary. So they came. They came. It was extremely successful. And, I mean, what a gift to partner with UW, who then, you know, kudos, invested in us to have a full-time medical social worker on site, two medical providers, a full-time nurse, so that nurse was present even during the week, you know, partnerships with pharmacies, because as you know, and most of the people that will be listening to this know, folks don't have enough time to go and get their medications. So we would go get their medications for them. We forged a partnership with Bartell Drugs. Like, everything what had been crafted to make this work. And it did.
And it's still going.
And it's still going.
Right.
And now it's every day. And it's
and
now
it's expanded.
It's expanded.
To...
So now we also have an Aurora Clinic, which serves male identifying humans and gender nonconforming humans. So it's a
full
shop
spectrum.
So anything you could get true, you know, at a oh my gosh, what's
primary
it?
Care.
Primary care, thank you. Primary care, you can get at our clinics.
Nice.
You know, including, you know, Suboxone. And it was also really interesting. During that time that we launched the She Clinic, we also had a, for the Global North, a large HIV outbreak in just a very small geozone, which was the Aurora Commons geozone. So as it happens too often in public health, you know, when you have an emergency, all of a sudden the funds become available. Right. And so that was part of why we were able to really create a beautiful holistic approach and really treat and incentivize care for those folks that were impacted by this wave of of HIV.
And then syphilis.
And then syphilis. Yeah. I mean, almost always.
Yeah.
So, yes.
And then the pandemic.
And then the pandemic. Right. Exactly. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, that's that's
successful.
The story of
Aurora Commons. So tell me, because you told me before we started the interview that you and your family have relocated more recently to Enumclaw, still in King County, considered
barely.
Barely closer to Tacoma for people that don't know, and definitely a different community. So can you tell me a little bit more about what that decision-making and what that transition has been like for you?
Oh, thank you for asking. Yeah, I think, you know, as I mentioned, I've spent 19 years living, like, just a block or two off of Aurora Avenue and in community and with intention. And it's the love of my life. But I did, and I do have the privilege of having two young kids.
Nice.
And, you know, I found myself mothering my community more than I was able to mother my children. And so with the deep acknowledgement that this life is fleeing.
And especially childhood.
And childhood goes.
It's too short.
So fast. I think the best way to describe it, Josephine, is if you were at a bowling alley and you put up those bumpers, I needed to put up some bumpers so that I could nail parenting and mothering because I want to. I felt blessed by the community at the Aurora Commons to go and mother. Charged, in essence, truly, by so many of the women that I love so much, that live with a deep grief from the separation of not being able to raise
losing,
their children.
Losing
like,
in print, yeah.
Truly, like, Sparrow.
That is a huge grief.
Go mother your children.
Wow.
At night, walking me home, night after night.
And reminding
Sparrow,
you.
Sparrow, go home. I mean, just exceptional. Like, exceptional. So I stepped down from the work that I love at the Aurora Commons.
And that was when?
That was 2.5 years ago.
2.5, okay.
And 2 years ago, moved my family off of Aurora and out to Enumclaw, as you mentioned.
And why Enumclaw?
You know, it's really interesting. My husband and I are very much like mystics and free spirits and are definitely like a ready, shoot, aim kind of a family.
Yeah.
So we were driving through Enumclaw after skiing.
There you go.
And we're like, this looks nice.
It's a cute town.
You know, it is. And I think also just being like, I mean, we did do like a little bit of research. We were really drawn to the fact that it is politically divided.
It is, definitely. You're around harm reduction.
I have, you know, lived my life alongside folks that have very similar political and ideological and moral conviction. And I find that problematic. and I think that part of the issues we face in our culture is our inability to turn and face one another and work across dividing lines. And that always impacts the poor. Always. So in essence, like, that was part of the draw of moving to Enumclaw, not to say that I am a goddess that can shift the hearts and the minds of the people, but to face my own inability for nuance, my own ways that I hold on to ideology like a religion, and have to kind of practice being in relationship with folks that think very differently mm-hmm. than me. Because, I truly do believe, not putting too much of a pat myself on the back, but, like, truly do believe, and I say this all the time, that, like, it's the people that are going to change the death-dealing policies. It's us that are going to vote for the levies. It's us that are going to, like, so if I can't be in relationship with folks that, and be curious and genuinely curious and try to build a bridge across otherness, mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of hope for democracy. And I happen to think that, like, because I've learned that, again, people that I love are dying unnecessary deaths because of death-dealing policies and, mm-hmm. and our divestment of funds. And when homelessness is growing, we're not investing. Our inability to defragmentize our systems and our structures. This is a change of heart.
And your kids' futures.
And our kids' futures. And so, not to put too much of a moral weight on my move, but, like, also it's just how I'm wired. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't help it. Like
finding community in a different space.
Yeah, I'm feeling called to unlearn and relearn how to be in relationship with a community of people I haven't had to be. I feel much more comfortable on the streets of Aurora than I do, honestly, oftentimes in conversations with folks that have different political beliefs than mm-hmm. me. I just find that problematic. So mm-hmm. I think both the access to the mountains, I will say that my nervous system has been able to rest.
Mm-hmm. The bumpers.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And I'm hope doing a good job mothering my children.
Nice. I'm sure so, you are. How are they doing with the transition?
Thanks for asking. Good. I mean, I think we really miss Seattle. Mm-hmm. Like, I always stop people when I'm out there. Like, people are like, well, where'd you move from? Seattle. I didn't hate Seattle. I actually love Seattle.
Seattle
Let
is
me
not
just stop
dying.
You there. Like, I have such a commitment to this place. Mm-hmm. So we miss it. Mm-hmm. We miss it deeply. But this is right for us in this moment.
Right.
And I think we have extreme gratitude for that. It also gives me the space. You know, I don't know if you know, but I am currently I did start a new nonprofit called Sacred Streets, mm-hmm. which is really beautiful.
So tell me about
but,
that.
But my 40 hours a week position mm-hmm. is with the King County Regional Homelessness Authority.
Okay.
So
and doing what?
Yeah. So my position is I'm the regional planner for Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
So my geo zone is Seattle, mm-hmm. which has been, you know, the place that I've given my time and my attention towards. So that is my 40-hour a week job. That was not in the original plan when I stepped from Aurora Commons.
Mm-hmm.
My plan was to create Sacred Streets, which was and is deep belief in community care mm-hmm. and building up in particular places community care and buoying our current system by coming alongside our unhoused neighbors and our service provider community
mm-hmm.
to nourish them and be a special assist, especially in times of transition.
Mm-hmm.
So again, like, bringing around circles of care, communities of care that buoy the isolation. Especially in times of transition, as we know, like, folks when they're transitioning from the streets to housing.
To housing, that can be really lonely.
And especially
and
with
scary.
Fentanyl. I mean, we've seen a massive increase of overdose mm-hmm. fatalities in the last 2 years in our government-funded housing.
Mm-hmm.
People die when they're alone.
Right. Oh, we saw that during the pandemic.
Right. We saw that during the pandemic. So, you know, for better or worse, our service provider community is doing the best they can.
Mm-hmm.
But we as a community need to buoy them. We need to come alongside in a way that we have within us. And our lives are better for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we know when we share our lives with these precious neighbors, our lives are enlivened. So we're missing out, mm-hmm. you know? I just think that we have so much we can do as a community and that we truly want to do. But we need invitations mm-hmm. and ways to be a part of creating economies of care and that cultures of care.
Wanted and needed.
Yeah, that are wanted people. And needed. Right. Yeah. And so that's truly what Sacred Streets is. Nice. There's a lot of different arms of what that looks like.
Is that mostly focusing in Seattle?
It is, yeah, predominantly. Mm-hmm. So we have I'm not sure if you're familiar with the work of Craig Rennebaum.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So Mental Health Chaplaincy has merged with Sacred Streets.
Oh, nice.
And
oh,
so
yay.
I feel deeply grateful. Shout out to Reverend Craig Rennebaum.
He's amazing.
Who has been a good teacher to me in my life, has asked myself to and Sacred Streets to continue on his legacy. So they have merged and are gifting us with their phenomenal bodies of work. Mm-hmm. And so we use within our trainings his accompaniment.
Right. Trainings. Walking beside.
And his relational outreach and engagement model.
Nice.
So that work continues, and it is time for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel a hunger and a bubbling up in this community to step in, mm-hmm. be alongside, and also we need a compelling story. And I feel like we are just so lacking in a narrative that invites us into the lives of mm-hmm. one another and weaves a fabric of belonging. So that's truly what Sacred Streets is.
Nice.
Is there to do and to witness and to feed and
right.
to fuel. And that work is happening. And as it happens, I continue to do the hardest work of my life, which is a deep calling to work for upstream change.
Mm-hmm.
Again, hearkening back to what I've learned from being alongside my neighbors.
Mm-hmm. So some of that, then I would imagine, through the Regional Homelessness Authority,
yeah.
your position there,
yeah.
which I know they've gone through mm-hmm. growing pains and
yeah, truly.
Things, right?
Yeah.
Looking for a new director. And,
truly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, truly.
So what are you is because it sounds like, I mean, parenting, moving to Enumclaw, growing Sacred Streets
yep.
yeah, alongside Craig Rennebaum's work and your work at the Regional Homelessness Authority,
mm-hmm.
which I imagine some of it is remote capability.
Yeah, about 3 days a week
yeah.
I'm able to work from home, and then 2 days a week I come in,
you come
pretty
in.
Much. But some,
right.
some other weeks it's more.
Yeah.
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 So, what are you doing or what do you hope to do in Enumclaw?
Great question. Yeah. So a couple weeks ago, I went into the middle school
mm-hmm.
and guest lectured.
Okay.
On homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
That was a real gift to my spirit. And it was very fruitful.
Nice.
So from that, I've actually been talking quite a bit with mm-hmm. their school social worker.
Oh, great.
Who works with McKinney-Vento students,
exactly,
of course.
Yeah.
And my goodness.
There are a lot.
My goodness. Mm-hmm. And so that's been almost once a week that I've been on the phone with her. I would really love to continue to grow that work.
Mm-hmm.
We must.
Mm-hmm.
We must. We must. I think so much of this, and I'm sure you can connect to this, as someone who is a quote-unquote service provider for 20 years on the ground, you always feel like, what am I missing?
Mm-hmm.
Is there like a magic phone? Is there like a – like?
Is there some upstream
Is there some
measure?
Up – like, what am I missing? certainly I'm missing something.
Mm-hmm.
I think so much of the gift that I feel like we are called as – the Regional Homelessness Authority is to provide clarity.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, Brené Brown says clarity is kindness. The ways that I can come alongside folks just even within my own context and provide some amount of clarity as to where you go, who you call,
mm-hmm.
also how you come alongside, even like what are the beautiful questions to ask? You know, I have gleaned that. I have learned that. I want to impart that and propagate that mm-hmm. in my own context. And so far, I've had, opportunities to do that.
there are so many more opportunities to do that in my context. And I'm never not thinking about how to do that. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I feel really called to, I'm part of something that's called the Othering and Belonging Institute. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the work of John Powell at UC Berkeley. It is such phenomenal work. So I'm part of a forum that is like a membership base. You have to apply to be a part of it, called the Democracy and Belonging Forum. And so it's all about the good, hard work of bridge building. Mm-hmm. Again, like towards the future of democracy. Mm-hmm. For the future. Which, again, to me is all about the impacts that it has on the poor. Mm-hmm. And again, the Poor People's Campaign have been huge teachers in my life and continue to be huge teachers in my life. So one of the things I really hope to do in the next season, and you can hold me accountable,
okay,
is create spaces of engaging in deep conversations across the political divide.
Nice. Yeah, we need that so much.
I feel deeply called to that, to building a bridge across otherness. It's such an artistry. I happen to be just like, for better or worse, like, I'm just not a pessimistic human. I also don't think, I think pessimism is a privilege.
Right. That we don't. Can be a cop out.
Yeah. That we just don't have time for. Nor I think when you have your hand on the heart of the people, like, I just can't. I can't
just
be
like
pessimistic.
Giving up on them.
Yeah. Like, I have too much reverence. Mm-hmm. So I think there's just, like, we have a real need, I think, especially in this city, to focus on possibility, to be really honest about where we're at. I think there's a lot that we can do with the resources we currently have. And I think pessimism is truly getting in the way of us collaborating towards future possibility. And I think where we see that most obviously and evidently is in our neighbors that are actively decompensating on our streets.
Yes.
I think it's hard to witness that.
Mm-hmm.
And that keeps us from turning towards one another and bearing hope. I think hope is a discipline. And I really want to see our community, our leaders, being humble enough to set a table and bring us together, turn and face one another, and create together possibilities. We have a moral obligation to do that. This is so unnecessary. And I hope that I continue to be able to give my days and my life to creating safe spaces where, you know, not only, you know, folks feel seen and valued and a part of something, but also encouraging hope and innovation and possibility with where I currently am, and that's in government. We are beholden to these precious neighbors. And if all I do every day is remind us of this, I just hope for sustenance for the journey so that I can continue to do that.
So,
nice. Yeah.
More coffee, more sustenance.
More soulful sustenance.
Soulful.
Yes.
More.
Yeah. But it's much easier to do when you're in relationship with people.
Yes.
That bless you, enliven you, and love you. And I just happen to be lucky enough to share my life with phenomenal humans.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see them live into their fullness.
Nice. That's beautiful.
I talked a lot.
No, it's all really important for people to know about and to hear. So is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to say?
I mean, I think if I can, you can cut this.
I would love to hear from you. I mean, you've sat with 60-some people now.
62. You're my 62nd.
My new favorite number.
That's right.
What are you hearing? Like, what are the themes of which you're gleaning through these conversations?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So, yeah, I've been doing these since summer of 2015. And that's – we've been through a lot as a society, as a city together, especially around homelessness and healthcare. Pandemic, you know, lessons learned, like some things that we know work, but at the same time, since we – you know, during that time of the official declaration of homelessness being an emergency, mm-hmm. it's just getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
Except for youth homelessness, we are doing a good job at that because it's, you know, pulling together. And then for me personally, because I still, you know, do direct service, direct clinical care, as well as teaching our nurses and, you know, future nurses and future physicians around compassionate care. So it is, it's like that balance of how do you navigate all of this, like, stuff and the naysayers and the Seattle is dying and, mm-hmm. you know, government is, like, messing, you know, just how to do that without despairing. Because I have sat with some people who their entire lives, like longer than you and I have been in it, I'm older than you, have been around this work. And it's, you know, it's like a check on ego too, right? Of like,
yeah,
you just keep doing this work. It, you know, you can't do that magic wand, mm-hmm. but how do you keep on with that work?
Mm-hmm.
I think is really important for all of us because I know so many people in our area who are – they're not the naysayers, but they're frustrated, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're seeing people die on the streets in front of them at bus stops.
And again, much of it is unnecessary.
Right.
Yeah.
That's just like this suffering and of what are we – what do we do? What do they do? And that's I really love the work of the authority mm-hmm. in terms of like even the website of mm-hmm. having here's what you can do, right?
Yeah,
it's a Herculean job of what mm-hmm. they've taken on, but thank you for all of the work that you do.
Well, thank you. I think you know I often say that like this is deep time work.
Mm-hmm.
That's a term that Joanna Macy, amazing poet, uses. But it is. It's deep time work. At the same time, it is like now. So I thank you for your deep time work and like want to take the opportunity to thank other folks. Last week I was sitting on Thursday. We had kind of the final interview for who very well may become our new CEO at KCRHA.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting there at City Hall looking around at Allison Isinger,
mm-hmm.
Chloe Gale from LEAD.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talk with Dan Wise, who's been at CCS for many, many years. We're getting together. I mean, these are people that have been in this deep time mm-hmm. work. And there's a sense, right? Like we are, like again, longer than me. I have 22 years, but longer than me. We're tired, and yet we must remain,
mm-hmm.
and we also must be hospitable to the new people that are coming in,
mm-hmm.
like this potential CEO. I'm tired of reorienting people to this particular place and mm-hmm. these particular people, but I have to be hospitable to the new people that are coming in to try to help us weave this together. And so I think there's a sense of like both the exhaustion, but also the tenacity and the deep time work that we're all committed to, that there's just like such – I felt overwhelmed by gratitude for – and feel it now, like just for the deep commitment that we have here to this particular place and to these particular people that are part of us. And I just – I'm really grateful and grateful for continuing to learn alongside. And we must encourage one another. And we must keep pointing to that North Star, right? Like,
and you brought me coffee today.
And I brought you coffee!
Spreading kindness. Thank you.
Thank you so, so good to, like, finally sit with you and gaze at you. Like, you're just such a good human. So grateful. So
likewise.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah.